justifying my decisions, you know, trying to show the benefit and the value, build versus buy types of things. And so the MBA came in. The way I looked at it was, it provides, you know, the knowledge and the leadership skills that technical folks like myself at that time, you know, need to really reach their full potential.
That is Mark Braga, Principal Architect Evangelist here at Salesforce. I'm Josh Burke, a Developer Evangelist for Salesforce, and here on the Salesforce Developer Podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Now, before we get started, a message from our marketing department. We would love to know more about what you think about the Salesforce Developer Podcast and how you listen to it. So we have put a survey out there, which you can find on our various social media feeds, including the Twitter account at Salesforce Devs. Now, back to the show. There, Mark was talking about how his MBA experience delves back into his former role as a program architect for Salesforce. But today, we're talking about the relatively recent team of architect evangelism and his role as an architect evangelist.
So it's an interesting role. I've always thought of it as the best and most fun aspects of that program architect role, kind of wrapped up all into one, because going into a new customer, understanding their challenge, providing solutions, that whole sort of like onboarding is super exciting. Also, the pre-sales activities of an architect are really exciting as well. It's where you're strategizing, you're brainstorming, and you're putting those implementation strategies like into place early on. And then things, you know, might get a little tactical after that. So the architect evangelist role, I mean, my goal and our goal in architect relations is really to inspire and empower, you know, architects, our customer architects, our partner architects, all the architects in the ecosystem. So for me, it's super exciting because the architect is probably the most trusted digital advisor, technical influencer in the ecosystem. You know, they're making decisions about whether or not to use our products and how they're going to use them, and ultimately if they're going to be successful using them.
Right.
What we do is we look for ways either through helping build foundations and standards, or like different channels to push material out on our blog or our upcoming website. Mm-hmm. Just looking for ways to engage with and empower and inspire that audience.
Okay, so the team just released something called decision guides. What are they and why did you put them out there?
Yeah, the decision guides are awesome. Our products are, you know, when we talk about the Salesforce products, we often talk about how, and we're marketing them as, you know, very simple, straightforward to implement. And that is oftentimes the case. But when you get into a situation that architects are typically in, when it's an enterprise environment, it's a lot more complex than that. And so and on top of that, we have so many, it's a good thing, but we have those three releases. We have so many automation options, so many tools.
Right.
And so the decision guides, and you'll see that kind of start to become a brand for our team with the architect relations as we release more of these decision guides, because they were so well received. But the particular ones that we released, you know, worked closely with our internal teams, was to help architects decide on how to make decisions between low code and pro code solutions, meaning when to use flow, when to use process builder, when to use workflow rules, when to use Lightning Web Components and Apex, and how to either make decisions between those choices or how to make decisions about when to combine them. So those two architect guides are divided between building forms, you know, on the front end. So things like dynamic forms and when to use those and Lightning Web Components and others. And then on the back end with like record changes and the other options that I just walked through. So,
and I think you're nearing the answer to this next question, but why start with those two? Why were they the priority?
There was a couple of reasons why we chose those at first. So first we were starting to do the before record change. Flow is now an event that you can work within Flow. And then we wanted to clarify a lot of, so nothing official had come out about what to do with process builder versus flow versus, and so the ecosystem, you know, would start to kind of fill those gaps. And we wanted to come out with kind of straight from Salesforce recommendations that were based on the research and the metrics that we know internally, and make kind of like a, you know, a recommendation to the ecosystem on officially, you know, this is what we think.
Yeah.
And that use case, those two use cases, the forms and the record change, are, you know, probably the two that are of the most, you know, in need right now, where architects are making day-to-day decisions and in all level of architect, platform mm-hmm. architects, you know, and solution designers and solution architects are making decisions on those points all the time. So,
yeah, I mean, it feels very not only core to how we're building out applications on the platform, but also, like, as you're saying, most blatant overlap of functionality that we have on the platform. Can you give me a taste? Like, for instance, I would probably lean to Process Builder versus Flow, but mostly just because, like, it's the devil I know kind of thing. So is there like a scenario that comes to your mind where if I'm walking into Process Builder, I'm definitely doing it the wrong way?
Yeah. So that's interesting that you say that, because like, if you're in the guide, it's officially, you know, they're kind of calling out, the internal teams are kind of calling out the end of life for Process Builder. Mm-hmm. So there's one.
And then that's a second, good one.
And then second, you know, if within that guide, they really did a good job of detailing the performance difference between Process Builder and Flow.
Gotcha.
So that was some of the best feedback that we got from the ecosystem, was just the honesty and the transparency about the decisions that we're making on our products and really mm-hmm. how they perform.
Yeah.
And so that's helping, you know, our architects make informed decisions. Because I'm with you, like, I was always going Process Builder. I would remove a lot of code and move it to Process Builder. And then there's a lot of unknown implications when you do that. And then you have also, like, how do you make a framework of, you know, should I have one, like, we recommend one Process Builder per object? Is that maintainable? Does that scale? So, yeah.
I'm also generally the kind of person who would lean to, you know, code versus click kind of thing. And if I can build a Lightning Web component quickly to do something, I will. But the concept of dynamic form, is there kind of a similar conversation there where it's like, no, like, a Lightning Web component is actually going to be less efficient than if I'm just using the thing that's on the platform?
Yeah, so there are still some limitations that are, again, and one of the nice things about the guides too is it calls out what those limitations are mm-hmm. Between each of the solutions that are being reviewed. Mm-hmm. And there still are plenty of limitations with dynamic forms. I mean, they're not GA yet, so they'll be built on. But one of the mm-hmm. things that jumps out at me really is when I was deciding to build a Lightning Web component, or when I needed to build a Lightning Web component, certain things like, you know, dynamic visibility of a field on a form.
Right.
You know, in real time, which somebody that's outside of our ecosystem is so used to being able to do that pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And of course you can do that very easily with a Lightning Web component, but that doesn't allow you, but you know, we're trying to say, okay, let's do what we can dynamic, declaratively first.
Right.
And so that's one that jumps out. Like, you can do that now with dynamic forms.
Yeah.
And so that eliminates a lot of the use cases where you would jump to, you know, okay, I need what would be what seems like a pretty straightforward form to build, and often surprises somebody that they would have to build a custom Lightning Web component to support that. Well, now you can do that declaratively.
So how do you see these guides like evolving? What's the future for them?
Yeah. So these guides, we're talking about that strategy now and like maintaining them. So our architect website is launching around Dreamforce. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, these guides and other guides will be a big part of the resources and artifacts that, you know, everybody can find on that website. So mm-hmm. today they live in Quip, public Quip documents.
Got it.
You know, announced on the blog, linked to the public Quip document. In the future, you'll find those types of resources on our architect website. Mm-hmm. And there'll be essentially an entire architect guides section on the website for similar type content. And so what we're doing now is kind of polling the ecosystem to understand where are the top areas that the architects in our ecosystem want these sorts of resources on. Mm-hmm. And they are around, you know, are really our architectural pillars of performance, scalability, maintainability, security, governance, cost optimization. So every guide will take a similar angle to what these first two guides did and come at it in the context of an architect, or put the architect lens on it, thinking mm-hmm. it against those pillars, those architectural domains. And then you'll start to see every guide or every piece of content that's on, every document that's on that website have a cross-cloud multi-product angle on it, like these guides do as well. Mm-hmm. And we'll start to have guides that help you make decisions about from a data architecture perspective, for, you know, like when to use platform events, when to use big objects, when to use external objects, standard objects, custom objects, sort of thing. Same thing with integrations, you know, will be the decision guides were received. I mean, something like close to 13,000 views in the first 90 days.
Right. Which is awesome. Congratulations.
Awesome. Yeah. So, you know, there's a big gap for that. And what that says is that, you know, I, for myself, when I was an architect, I'm still an architect, but when I was, right. You know, in consulting,
yeah.
I needed this, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know,
it was the manual you didn't even know you were missing.
Exactly. You know, and it's always on every architect's list to build one, you know?
Sure. Are there other things rolling out with the website that you want people to know about?
Yeah. So there's a couple other things. We are also working on a diagramming framework so that, you know, there'll be, you know, a standard set of components and diagrams that our ecosystem can use to download and build, you know, the diagrams that they need to for their customers and their organization, system landscapes, SSO flows, capability maps, those sorts of things with a standard library of components and symbols that, you know, they don't need to start from scratch. And it's clear what each of the icons represents and templates that they can use to, you know, start for either their use case, their industry, et cetera. Because again, architects know, like when you go to build it, you're typically starting from one that you've already built. So you can use the same sort of look and flow, but mm-hmm. you're always starting from scratch a bit. There's not that standard library that you can use. And so we want to be able to provide that. And that's something we're excited to do within the website.
How have you found like adjusting to like communicating with the community and reaching out and letting people know that you're in the role and stuff like that when you're having to do it all virtually?
Yeah, it's definitely different because as you know, the evangelist role is so much about engaging with the community. And I was so used to, you know, especially in the consulting role, being on the road.
Yeah.
And doing that in person. And that's a big part of what I'm excited to get back to in this evangelist role.
Yeah.
For instance, we had a South Florida Dreamin' convention that was canceled. It wasn't moved. And so luckily over the years, I've formed a solid network of, you know, customers and partners that I reach out to. So like we've held a few workshops and I've been able to reach out to that network. I've also, you know, the LinkedIn community has been fantastic. So gathering, like when we're making decisions on that diagramming framework, for instance, or, you know, sharing the decision guides and getting feedback on those, all our different social channels have been huge. So where I would have, and where I was expecting to do so much in person, you know, it's like you said, it's been a challenge to try to adjust and pivot that. But I think we've been successful. And now we have marketing support for our architect relations team, too. So I just expect that to, you know, help even more. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. So I do want to touch on something that you have talked about on stage before, specifically technical debt. It's something the industry talks about a lot, maybe sometimes talking more than actually doing anything about it. First of all, how would you as a architect define technical debt?
Okay. Yeah, that's a good topic. Because it's everywhere.
Right.
And one that I've talked about in the past on webinars, and it was actually my South Florida Dreamin' event session was going to be on that. But yeah, so technical debt, it's a liability mm-hmm. and it's incurred due to poor quality or suboptimal solution design. Mm-hmm. And it can be planned or unplanned. Most cases it's unplanned, but I think the reality is that, and most of us need to be aware that it's also you plan for technical debt as well. You planned it in sometimes. And it's expedient in the short term, you know, to do that and mm-hmm. can be costly to maintain and support in the future. So yeah, I guess if that sums it up, it's a liability that you have within your system, within your infrastructure, and it can come from either poor quality of an implementation or a suboptimal design.
So I want to pick up on that thread a little bit more because that's really interesting to me. So planned technical debt would be when you're intentionally in a planning phase for something. And how does that work then? Is it like you're pointing at one part of the architecture and you're like, we realize this is flawed, but it's also going to get us to our deadline.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So let's say you have an example would be you have a dependent system mm-hmm. that is also being either procured or built at the same time, mm-hmm. and their schedule is not going to be met. And so you have to come up with an alternative so that your system, in this case, let's say it's launching Sales Cloud, and one of the integrated systems is also being sunset and replaced with something else.
Yeah.
You know, and that one's not ready, and you're building, you're incurring technical debt by building dependencies for the old system, knowing that the new system will come online eventually.
Got it. And I'm just going to go ahead and apologize for anybody who has seen some of my very, very old code. But at a previous job, I used to make a habit of putting a comment above a line of code that would say something along the lines of, this is the hackiest thing I'll do all day. So as a developer, I'm sure I have increased technical debt myself.
Yeah. And so similarly, we capture that in Jira or whatever else you might use for your agile project management. You know, we're capturing with similar snarky type comments on like, oh, we know we shouldn't have this in there, but we're planning for this technical debt, and let's keep a sprint at the end for taking care of that.
Right. And there's nothing quite like a developer trying to hunt down a bug and you see a reference to somebody naming out another engineer who's no longer in the company.
There you go. I can't imagine if I went back and looked at the code that I wrote compared to like what people are able to do nowadays. It's like,
I feel like that's like developer purgatory. Like that's going to be our circle of hell at some point, where it's just like you have to go look at your code from like, it's not like the code you wrote yesterday. It's like the code you wrote like 10 years ago. And this came up in a previous episode. I was at a barbecue with a company, this company, the hackiest code all day company that I worked at. And I had left the company, but I was still coming to the barbecues to hang out with my old employees. I'm talking to these two guys, and then they ask me who I am, because I'm like not a player there. And I'm like, oh, I'm Josh. And the look of fear and awe on their face. And I'm like, oh, you're the front end developers now.
Now, okay, we could put a name to that comment, a face to that comment.
Right, exactly. I don't think I showed up to any other barbecues after that. Okay, so let's talk broadly a little bit about this. Like, what are some common symptoms of technical debt itself? Like, what is an org feeling from that?
So, like, from a Salesforce perspective especially, you might see, like, you're getting, let's say, like, complaints about the user experience, or you're getting performance issues, you're hitting governor limits, that sort of thing. Let's say you have an abnormal amount of admin support requests. Mm-hmm. And that's telling you that either something wasn't built correctly to meet the use case or the business need or the requirements that that really needed for that process.
Yeah.
And so like those are typically, indicators that is either poorly designed or the quality of the code, you know, or the quality of the implementation is not where it needs to be.
What are some specific strategies for combating technical debt once it's actually in the organization itself?
Yeah. So first and foremost, just be real about the fact that it exists, identify it, document it, have a plan to clean it up. So like I said, you know, dedicating a sprint or dedicating stories within a sprint. Mm-hmm. To plan to clean that technical debt up, then have ways to avoid it. And so ways that you can avoid it are, you know, establishing and enforcing a strong governance model between IT and business. So everybody has skin in the game and they're aligned on the objectives. So at least the situation where we talked about when you can identify it, if there's a ton of admin requests in the process and what the user experience isn't meeting the need, ensuring that those objectives are being met earlier.
Got it.
That also, that governance board we said identify it and document, because it's one thing to say, okay, we know we're doing this, and then and to your point, a new team rolls in or a different consulting firm comes on,
right,
and it's lost,
right.
And so first and foremost, be documenting, you know, the technical debt that you're aware of, and then as part of that governance model, doing, you know, periodic reviews of when you're going to clean it out. Mm-hmm. And periodic reviews to avoid any further, you know, buildup of technical debt.
Yeah.
And then the other thing you can do is, you know, do a app rationalization exercise and understand whether it's a better decision to buy it versus build it. You know, it's often, in most cases, buying instead of building is less expensive and easier to maintain in the long run. Mm-hmm. And you're not incurring technical debt that you might have if you were to build it. Mm-hmm. And so that's an option. And of course, we have the AppExchange for a lot of those types of situations. And then make your architecture and your designs modular, focus on like connected systems and system oriented architecture so that you're planning accordingly with your engineers about when you can retire certain elements of technical that you might have planned in.
Gotcha.
And you can do it in a way that doesn't impact the entire system.
And that's our show. Now, before we go, I did ask Mark about his favorite non-technical hobby, and there seems to be a growing trend within the pod episodes and the fact that one of the things that he really likes to do is just going outside.
So anything on the water outside with my kids. So nice. We do a lot of boating, a lot of tubing, fishing, and paddle boarding. So like anything I can get the kids out of the house, outside, especially right. on the water, mm-hmm. That's a blast. So
nice. The wife and I are really trying to get our kayaks out on the water whenever they open up the beaches. But I do have to, it is one nice thing about a boat. It is pretty easy to do social distancing.
That's true. And I didn't buy a boat. I joined a boat club. So I avoided all like the maintenance and storage of a boat.
Wise.
So that, they luckily kept that open. So there was social distancing and then, I can, avoid all the other responsibilities that come with a boat.
I want to thank Mark for the great conversation. Of course, I want to thank you for listening. Now, if you want to learn more about the podcast, head on over to developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can hear old episodes, see the show notes, and have links to your favorite podcast service. And once again, remember, we would love to know your opinions about the Salesforce Developer Podcast. So head on over to our social media feeds, especially our Twitter account @SalesforceDevs, for a survey. Thanks again for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.